Yeah. Hi, I'm Dan Snyder. I started at Microsoft in 1996, a few months before we shipped Word 97. So while I didn't design any of the stuff we're going to talk about, I need the clicker, I have had ample opportunity to learn to love it all, or at least to deal with it. There we go. Okay. This presentation, we're going to go through first a quick overview of where the book is and kind of how it's laid out, some key sections in it, and a little bit about how the format as a whole works. I read over the surveys that you all filled out, and so I sort of tailored this around the kinds of things that you all are interested in or that showed up repeatedly. Text extraction was the big one, so we'll spend a bunch of time on that, go through an example of it. We'll talk about properties to the extent that we have to in order to get on to the next section. Properties weren't something that showed up that much, but you really have to understand it to be able to look for objects of any kind. So then we'll talk about floating pictures, inline pictures, OLA objects, things like that. Text boxes was one that cropped up. And at the end, we'll talk about editing, some of the pitfalls, why it's hard, how you should get around that, things like that. Oops, I will learn how this works. Okay, if you look for MS-DOC in brackets, you'll find the book. It shows up right after the Mississippi Department of Corrections. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to mean or take from that, but oh well. It's the only one with brackets in it. I put a link here on the assumption that you'll get a copy of the deck. No need to scribble down the link. And there's also a PDF version available if you want some bedtime reading or whatever. Okay, the important sections in there, the first thing, if you're just arriving and wanting to learn about this format, is section 1.3 is the sort of complete overview of the whole thing. And it's mostly just links to other sections, but it talks about, okay, here's where you can find out about text, here's where you find out about pictures, here's where you find out about tables, and then what else is in there, because the document itself is long and pretty dense, but this is a good roadmap that can help you find what you're looking for. 2.2 is fundamental concepts, and one thing that's going to show up when you deal with this format is there are very, very few fundamental concepts, and they just get repeated over and over and over again. So I like to describe it as there's nothing, but there's a whole lot of nothing. Section 2.4 is the heart of it. Very dense algorithms to do just about everything you want to do, including the complete property hierarchy. There's one section in there that is, starting with a CP, a character position, how do you find out everything about it? Character properties, table boundaries, paragraph boundaries, all of it. I mean, it's a long process, but the whole thing is in that section. And then the overview of tables is there also in case you're interested in all the table-related terminology. Section 3 is the examples. These are detailed. They talk about, here's the offsets in the file, here's what you find there. They go through step by step the kinds of things. There's one on text, there's one on properties, there's one on lists, and a few other things. Okay, the top level, at the very top level, a DOC file is an OLA structured storage file. If you're on Windows, there are APIs to deal with these things, storage, open storage, storage, create doc file, etc. Find those on MSDN, and they link to all the things you may need. If you're not on Windows, the MSCFB book, in brackets, I have no idea which Department of Corrections it's after, but that one is that whole format for any platform you want. Though, if you're not on Windows, your platform may have an iStorage implementation already, so before you go cracking open MSCFB and trying to implement it, you might look around. The only things you can count on in a Word document file are that there will be a stream called Word document and that there will be a structure called a FIB, file information block, living at offset zero in that document. The FIB points at everything else. So it's just an array of offsets. It says, at offset 500 in the table stream, you'll find whatever. The offsets are not in any particular... The locations it points to are not in any particular order. You can't rely on, I always know that the character properties show up starting at offset 400. No, they don't. They show up wherever the FIB says they do. That's a common pitfall that people get into, is just jumping to a particular spot and thinking that it's always going to be there. Okay, talking about some fundamental concepts, we're going to go over a couple. In order to get to text extraction, we have to be able to talk about two things, CPs and pleces. A CP is just a character position. It's a number that describes logically... It's like a logical index of a character in the document. It has nothing to do with where that character's text is in the file or anything else like that. It's just, the first character in the document is CP0, second one CP1, etc. Sometimes the text will be 2 bytes wide if it's Unicode. Sometimes it's 1 byte wide. If it's not, whatever, it's always one CP. And the other thing about CPs is that everything counts. So if you're looking at a document, it's hard on visual inspection to figure out where your CPs are, because things like object anchors and table cell marks and paragraph marks and all these other things count as CPs. If you want to be able to reference it and hang properties off of it, odds are pretty good it's a CP somewhere. The other concept, fundamental concept that shows up again and again is a police, PLC in the book. It has two purposes. It'll either map a range of CPs to data about those CPs, or it'll map single CPs to data about those CPs. The storage in the file is exactly the same, and each police will tell you which kind of thing it's doing. In this example, I have an array of CPs there. In a police, the array of CPs is always sorted. This is handy so that you can binary search it if you want to look for something instead of having to linearly hop through it. There's always one more CP than there is data block. So over there, I've got five CPs and only four data blocks. And the reason is that the last CP tells you the end of the range of the last one. So the last data block there refers to data about the range from 29 to 119 in the document. If we're talking about a point, like the CP members referring to points instead of ranges, the last one's kind of useless, but it's still there anyway. Again, the storage on the disk is exactly the same. And then the first data member is about CP0. Each police has its own data type. The book tells you which kind of thing it is. They're all different sizes, etc. Now we have enough to talk about text extraction. There is an example of this in section 3.1 of the book. Again, starting from the top, every document has a CLX, which is a structure you can find by looking at that place in the fib there, fib, RGF, CL, CB, 97, whatever. That FC, you'll see again and again, that means file character, and it's just an offset, byte offset into a stream somewhere. Each FC in the fib will tell you in the book which stream you're in. Some of them are in the Word document stream. Some of them are in the table stream. Occasionally, there's one in the data stream. And the book says which stream to go to. The CLX contains a PCDT. Not very interesting. The PCDT contains this police PCD, also sometimes called a piece table. The police PCD, now it's a police just like any other. It maps CPs to ranges of text about those CPs. To information about those CPs. And then finally, that information called a PCD includes where, again, as an FC, you can find the text. So if we start with this police PCD here, it's got four CPs, so three blobs of data. The first one refers to the CPs from 0 to 5, etc. I expanded out there in the data what you can find in the PCD. There's the FC number, and then there's this bit that says whether it's compressed or not. And if that bit is true, then you have to divide the FC by 2 to find your text. So that's the second and third examples there. F compressed is 2. F compressed is true, so we divide the FC by 2 to find 400 instead of 800, or 407 instead of 80E. The first one is not compressed. His FC is C22, and then the actual FC is actually C22. I built this file on purpose. You'll get a copy of this with the slide deck wherever Michael shares them. I built this file this way on purpose. This was an incremental save from Word 10, or Word XP, sorry. I chose that because it demonstrates the idea that the FCs being referenced by the pieces there need not be in order in the file. 400 shows up before C22, even though the text involved comes after it logically in the file. This is showing why CPs and FCs are a mapping, and you can't assume the text that shows up in one order in the file is that way in the document. And then finally, you jump to the text. I laid it out that way on purpose, again showing you that over there is hello, which was actually the beginning, and then there's world, and then a couple carriage returns. And so that's the whole process of jumping through looking for text. In order to find properties, we start with those FCs, and let me go back up to the fib again and try to figure out where properties are. One more thing. Text in places that is not the main document, text in interesting places, there's a section in the book, 2.3, that talks about document parts, the headers, the footers, the text boxes, endnotes, comments, things like that. In CP space, they're all rammed together in the document, so it might be first the main document, then the headers. I forget which order they're in, but it's in the book. The police PCD refers to the whole thing as one giant CP space. And so if you, you know, if you want to read from the main dock all the way through, it's just increasing numbers. For parts that aren't the main document, though, things like text boxes, for example, you have multiple text boxes, but there's only one text box document part. And there's another police that tells you the boundaries between the text boxes, another one for the boundaries between the headers or the boundaries between the comments. That's useful if you're trying to figure out, I mean, you can get all the text out just by doing the algorithm I just went over, but if you want to try to figure out where that text is in terms of, oh, wait, this is header text, not main document text, or, oh, this is text boxes, not main document text, knowing which text box you're talking about, knowing which header you're talking about is useful. Most of the pleces in the book work like the police PCD does in that they span all the document parts. They don't stop at one and start over. Field pleces is the big example of one that doesn't work that way. So there's a field please for the main doc and a field please for the header, etc. We'll talk more about fields when we get to OLE objects later on. Now about properties. Properties are introduced in 1.3, of course. They're also a fundamental concept. And 2.4.6 is that one I was talking about that gives you the complete property hierarchy from table style, conditional table formatting, all the way down to direct character formatting and how to apply each level in between. Properties are stored as an array of differences, not as an absolute expansion. So there's nowhere in the document that says the empty property set is whatever. You know, it happens to be Times New Roman and 10 points and a whole bunch, you know, not bold, a whole bunch of other things like that that you can get if you boot up an old copy of Word and start typing. But that's not in the file anywhere. The way you figure out what the default is you find the definition of each of the sperms, each of the character properties you're interested in, and you figure out what you're supposed to do if it's not there. Each one of them says that. They're encoded in what we call a PERL, which is a single property modifier or sperm followed by an operand. For example, down there, color followed by green, or underline followed by double, or bold followed by off, etc. Again, if it's not, if a property doesn't show up anywhere, then the description in section 2.6 of that property will tell you what to do. For example, if you don't see bold anywhere in the property stack, then the text is not bold. If you don't see font size anywhere in the property stack, then the font is 10 point. Each property has its own default value. Whoops, wrong way again. Okay, so we're going to talk about only direct formatting of text because it's the one that you need to do in order to get further around to things like objects and whatnot. This comes from example 4. Again, starting from the fib, every document has this thing called a plecef BTE chipx, which maps from the FCs that we cooked up when we were looking for the text. It maps from that to where to find the properties for text in that range. This plece is somewhat special in that it doesn't map CPs, but it maps FCs, which is good because you just got FCs when you were doing that previous thing. So once you found the FC of the text, just hold on to that, and then you can run it through here. Then the chipx FKP tells you about properties. So here's a very simple one. It has just one entry. It says that from FC 400 to 411, this is from a different file than the original example, you can find your text at page number 3. A page is 512 bytes. The reasons for that are somewhat historical, having to do with the section or the sector size on a floppy disk. But at any rate, right now it's 512 bytes. You just remember that. You multiply by 512. So we go to offset 600 hex, and we find this thing called the chipx FKP. Chipx FKP is always 512 bytes in size. And the only other thing you know about it is that at the very last byte down there, there's a C run, which in this case is 3. And that tells you how many runs of text you're dealing with inside this chipx FKP. Each run of text has its own set of properties. This should look a lot like a plece. Again, you've got, for if C run is 3, you've got 4 things up there, and then 3 or 4 FCs up there, and then 3 blobs of data underneath them. It's again the same thing over and over and over again. The file format has, like, you know, 3 concepts. This one tells you that the run that goes from FCs 400 to 407, you can find its properties at offset 1F4 inside the FKP. Those RGBs are a byte. And what you do to figure out where the properties are is you double that byte and then take that offset into the chipx FKP. I should probably stop here and ask, does anyone have questions about what I've covered so far? Because I'm going kind of fast and deep. Yeah. Yeah.
Could you possibly explain some of the acronyms, because I'm getting a little overloaded?
Sure. Okay, sorry. A plece is a plece of a plex of CPs. A plex is a variable length array. I don't know that that'll help much. When we wrote the book, we deliberately used our internal variable names as much as possible in order to make it easier for us to debug later. If somebody shows up and says, you know, in one of the forums, you know, hey, I have this problem with this structure over here, I don't have to go try to remember again which structure that really is. I just look it up in the code. So a lot of these acronyms come from what we actually use inside. A chip is character properties. So a chip X is a character property exceptions, if that helps. FKP originally stood for formatted disk page. I don't know why they chose K to mean disk. I wasn't here. In the code, it's, you know, formatted disk page, and the K is capitalized. Go figure. RGB means array of bytes. RG means array. And FC, I already mentioned, means file character or position in a file. So what this thing is doing is mapping the file positions we found to entries in this array of bytes. Each of those array of bytes is one byte, obviously. But since the FKP is 512 bytes big, you can multiply by 2 and still not go off the end. Anyone have any other questions before I keep going with this? Yeah. Right, so the question was, is this format more like Word's internals, and XML or OpenXML is taken on top of this and parsed? This format is a lot closer to Word's internals than OpenXML is. Trying to write this straight out to XML would have been an exercise in headaches. There's still some parsing that goes on, and the more we go, I mean, this format hasn't changed fundamentally since Office 97. I mean, we keep adding properties to it all the way up through Office 2003. So the more we go, the more processing there is involved. When this was originally conceived ages ago, it was a pretty straight dump of what's actually in there. But you can imagine all kinds of ways where this works great on disk, but you can imagine, for example, separating those things out, or when you load up a plece, there's no reason to keep it in memory, two things rammed against each other, even though that's what it is in the file, things like that. But yeah, this has a lot more to do with Word's internals than OpenXML does, which, you know, having XML as your native file format, you know, you're always going to translate into something when you load it, even if that's the only format you save. I suppose you could build a format where you have your whole thing be a DOM and try calling around in it, but you'll find it's much faster if you parse into something else and manipulate that. Once we find the offset of the properties, we'll go and look at what those properties actually are. I wanted to point out, though, that, again, these things aren't necessarily sorted. The first offset to the properties goes to 1F4, and the second one goes to 1F0, which comes before it. So you can't go assuming things about where you're going to get pointed. You just do whatever the thing says. You find the first entry, and you double that number, and you go to that spot. Right, so now we've finally found the chip X, which is the array of character properties. I chose this one on purpose because it demonstrates this idea of the last one wins. The first thing in there is a CB, or count of bytes. Tells you how big the chip X is going to be. This one's 9 bytes. Every sperm is 2 bytes, so the sperm itself anyway. So sperm C ICO there fills up 2 bytes and has a 1 byte operand, so that's 3. The operand of the sperm C ICO is 7, which, if you look in the book, it maps an ICO is an index to a color array. This comes from Word 97's color palette, which had 17 colors in it, and orange was not one of them. I don't know what they had against orange, but there you go. So this text wants to be orange, but when I think I saved this one from Word 2003, but it doesn't really matter. Any version beyond 2000, we added 24-bit color support to Word in Word 2000 in order to better support HTML, which had more than 17 colors, go figure. But when we save files, we want to make sure that earlier versions of Word can read them. If I only save that second one, sperm CCV there, he takes a 4-byte color operand, which is orange. I didn't bother to expand out what orange looks like. It's just RGB. It's all in the book. If I only wrote out sperm CCV, then Word 97 would not see any color at all applied to this document because it ignores any sperms it doesn't understand. So in order to make this work, you write out first the thing for the down-level version you care about, and then you write out your own thing on top of it so that when you go through and apply, last one wins, and you see orange. We don't do some kind of crazy alpha blending. It's not like it's yellow and orange. It's just orange. That brings me to one more important point about properties, which is that multiple sperms can talk to the same property, and you don't want to think of your property set as the collection of sperms. You want to think of it as the collection of properties. So the fact that both of these refer to color, okay, you have one idea of color, and you keep stomping it, as opposed to having, well, this is the color I got from there, and this is the color I got from over here, and I'll think about it later, because if you have two ideas of color, you won't know which one matters. If I were to flip the order of those, the text would be yellow. So it's all about last one wins. And again, that we explain that in 2.2.5. And one of the links from 2.2.5 is a footnote to the list of which versions speak which ranges of sperms. And it's always additive. It's not like there's some thing that Word 97 understood that, you know, Word 2003 dropped. So if you don't want to deal with this all the way back to the Stone Age, you can decide, hey, I don't care if Word 97 can open my files. I won't bother. Yeah. Yeah.
We're still, as part of you discovering them.
Okay.
So we're encountering pre-counter documents, pre-counter .40 documents, pre-counter Word 3.0 and Word 95, and some ancient documents. And for us to be able to process them becomes obviously a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, this book doesn't cover anything before that. There might be a book up there that does. I don't remember, but I don't know really anything about it. I don't know what your constraints are or what you're allowed to do with the documents, but certainly saving them through a converter to RTF or something might be easier than trying to parse them yourself. Again, I don't know in your line of business how critical it is that it be exactly the file that...
Well, obviously we have to preserve it.
Sure, you have to save the original as well, yes. But if you're trying to get like a text extraction or something, I don't know. Right, of course.
Yeah.
Right, fair enough. Right. Oh, because if you're only allowed to use the native application, you should just use Word itself. But
you're not necessarily limited to that, as long as you can be assured that whatever program you use to put that document to the newest version or to the newer version is accurate and is something that you can legally defend.
Right. Okay. We should probably talk about that more at the one-on-one session. I noticed it in your surveys as well. Yes. Oh dear. yeah, the formats are different. I mean, the older ones do use these kinds of concepts, you know, CPs and pleces and sperms and all that, but I don't think the sperms are 16 bits wide in those formats, but I don't know for sure. Okay. Now that we've done properties and text, we know enough to be able to find things, shapes and such. So floating shapes are pretty easy to find, actually. There's text for the anchor character. Again, everything has a CP. So the floating shape has a CP, and the text for that anchor character is the Unicode value 8. It must also have sperm CF spec with a value of 1. Sperm CF spec takes a single byte operand. And that must be applied as direct formatting. Finally, that CP has to appear in a plesef SPA. SPA is for shape anchor, I think. And so you can find the plesef SPA by looking through the fib, just like anything else. And if your application is you want to look for the floating objects, The best way to do it would be to search through the PLECEF SPA, and then once you find those, go check the text it's pointing at to see if it's actually character 8 and actually has the sperm CF spec applied to it. The data for PLECEF SPA is a SPA. Again, we tend to append whatever the data name is at the end of the string PLECE or PLECEF. And eventually that will take you over to the MSO draw book, which is where you get the actual data out of the shape, like what's the texture fill and all that stuff. That's for floating shapes. Inline pictures, sadly, is a little harder. Again, these are all covered and introduced in 135, which links you around. The Unicode character for inline pictures is 1 instead of 8. It still has sperm CF spec applied. Sadly, though, there's no PLECE to tell you where the inline pictures are. Word doesn't have one internally. I mean, we build one as we load the file, but there's nothing in the file that tells us where these things are to start. There will also be, in addition to the sperm CF spec, there's a sperm C pick location applied also as direct formatting. Again, same thing from before. That one takes a 4-byte operand that tells you the offset where you can go jump over and find actual picture data associated with the thing. Sadly, like I said, there's no PLECE, which means that the only way to find all of these things is to run the text extraction algorithm, crawl through the whole document looking for character ones. And then check to make sure there's a sperm CF spec and then do all this stuff. You know, check to see if you have a sperm C pick location. Does anybody have questions about those two? Yes?
Documentation for finding that C pick location is not great.
Okay. Documentation for what you find at C pick location. Yeah, it's a null pick F and something or other. Yeah, we should certainly talk about that if you have specific concerns about that one. But yeah, it's in, I think, the data stream, and it's one of these things that forks off again to be multiple things depending on what you're pointing at. Sometimes in this format, the documentation is doing an accurate description of describing something that's not great. So it's a bit more Byzantine than it probably would be if we were trying to actually release it for the public. If we were building a word processor from scratch with a format that the world wanted to see, we might not have chosen this one. Yes. Okay. Before we can get to OLE objects, though, we're going to have to start talking about fields. OLE objects is an example of a field. There are many others, you know, author, page, include text, a bunch. There's an example down there of how a field is laid out in CP space. It begins with a field begin character. In this case, it's CP0. There's some amount of instruction text. I chose the author field because it's easy. There's a field separator character that marks the boundary between the instruction text and the result text. And then there's whatever the result is. All of that stuff is, for most fields, in CP space itself. So you don't have to know how to calculate the author field if you just want to extract the text from this. You just have to know which side of that boundary you're on, depending on your application, whether you want to see the string author or the name or both. In Word itself, you can flip between the two modes. You can edit the field codes directly, or you can flip over and look at the results. By default, you're seeing the results when you open a document. Fields are stored in a PLECE. Field PLECE is an example of one where it's not about ranges, it's about points. The field PLECE tells you that there is a field begin character at CP0 and a separator at CP7 and an end at CP21. It won't tell you that the range from 0 to 7 is all the instructions of this one field. Fields can nest. So here's an example of what the CP, what the PLECE FLD would look like for this document, 0, 7, and 21. The FLD is one of these structures that is different things depending on its first byte. So we always, in the book, it's an FLDCH followed by, FLDCH field character, followed by this thing called a GRF FLD, GRF FLD, which is different things depending on what it is. So for the beginning character, the top one up there, the GRF FLD is a number that tells you what kind of field it is. Again, 2.9.90 has the complete list. For the separator character, you ignore the data entirely, and for the end, there's a group of flags, which we'll get to in a minute, but for the author field isn't very important. So if you're looking for OLE objects, you should go through hunting for OLE fields. You find one with the FLDCH equals 13. That tells you it's a field begin. The GRF FLD is going to be one of those four numbers, embed, link, controller, HTML control. most of the ones you're probably interested in are going to be embed or link, and probably most of the ones you're really interested in are embed. Control and HTML control are for ActiveX controls, and depending on your application, you may not care. Anyway, the data stored in them is often not as interesting. It's not going to be an Excel sheet or anything like that. It's you know, an example would be a push button or an input line or a drop-down list or one of those little programmatic form control things. You need to find all three of the field characters for the field in order to do all the stuff we're going to talk about. You have to be careful. Fields can nest. So you don't know that the next field in the police or the next field character in the police belongs to this field. It might be another begins. You might find, you know, a begin followed by another begin, and that means you've got a nested field. So you have to find the end of that one, and then you can look again to see if you've got your separator showing up yet. And the same thing on the other side. Once you've found your separator, there could be more fields in the result. So you go look and see, okay, I've got another begin. That means I have to keep looking. Eventually, though, you figure out which of these three guys, which of the three entries in the field please correspond to your field. You have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you need the beginning to tell if it's the kind of field you care about, and then the middle and the end we'll get to. Zombie fields. I don't know why this is here. I just documented it. If the end character has this special bit called zombie embed set on it, then never mind, you're not dealing with an embed field, even if it looks like you are. There won't be any data for it. It's just this empty thing. You'll probably find a result. It might even have a picture in it, but there's not going to be any data backing it up. I made a note here about section 2.9 in the book where some of these more basic structures are. 2.9 is the spot where we put structures sort of at the bottom, the leaf nodes of the tree. It was, you know, things that didn't have a home anywhere else. It's alphabetical, so sometimes if we have to add something, the section numbers may move around, but the links you have to it on MSDN are always going to be the same, and since it's alphabetical, it can't be too hard to find them. Just look at the table of contents and find the thing you're looking for. And then links from the rest of the book will always work. It's not like the link from the field section is going to take you to 2.9.9.110 regardless of what's there. Those get updated automatically when we rebuild the book. Anyway, assuming you don't have a zombie field, you can find the OLA data by finding the field separator. So the field separator character has applied to it a bunch of sperms there, all is direct formatting, that will tell you how to go and get the actual data for your OLA field. It has to have sperm CF spec with an operand of 1, has to have sperm CF OLA 2 with an operand of 1. If it doesn't have one of those things, you either have a corrupt file or something else is weird. Finally, it'll have sperm CPIC location with a non-zero operand. And that one is different than the other sperm CPIC location. That one tells you what the name of the storage is that you're looking for that has all the data for the OLA object. Convert it to base 10, put an underscore on the front of it, and then there's a storage from the root called object pool, and inside that you'll find a storage with that name, and there is whatever the OLA server chose to put there. Do we have any questions? In the inline picture case, zero might be a valid value for sperm CPIC location. It just means that it offsets zero in the data stream is where you go. For one of these, it won't be zero. It'll be something else to tell you the name of the thing in there. I mean, you can try even if you get zero. You know, go ahead, stick an underscore in front of zero and see if you find one. I don't think you will, but no harm. But yeah, that's the data itself is whatever the server chose, whatever the OLA server chose to put. So if it's an Excel sheet, then it's whatever Excel wanted to put there. There's a couple of little streams that Word might put there itself, and those are documented in the book. But the thing you're looking for when you want to say, I want to find the Excel sheet, that's all an Excel file. There's nothing Wordish about it. It's all a black box. The presentation, OLA objects store a presentation in addition to the object data. That's so that you can go to a machine that doesn't have whatever that OLA server was installed and still be able to get something out of it, still be able to see what it looks like, still be able to print it. The presentation here is just the field result of the field. The field result, remember, was everything between the separator and the end. So all you do is go back and find the end, and all the text between there, that's your thing. For most Olay fields, it's just going to be an inline picture character is what you'll find for the result. But if it's an Olay link, then the link format might have been a text-based one, like text, HTML, or RTF, in which case the result could be arbitrary. It's you know, could be an entire another document in there. And you'll need to figure out, again, based on what you're trying to do, you know, do you want the original, do you want the presentation? Totally up to you. Olay links in Word don't push back into their sources. So if the user goes and plunks data into that result, which he might have done, the next time the field updates, his data gets blown away and replaced with whatever came in from the field. Or came in from the other end of the Olay server. But it's possible the guy could go and type stuff in there and you'll have some weird block of text that isn't what was in the document or what was in the original server. You'll have whatever the guy typed there instead. Floating Olay objects are the same as inline ones except that they live in the text box document instead of in the main document. And the text boxes. I think there's a way you can tell if a particular text box is an Olay object, but the easiest way to find them is just look through the field piece of the text box doc, trying to find do the same algorithm, just run it on the other field piece instead of on the main document's field piece. All the same stuff applies. There's an inline picture. There's all this stuff. The text box part is defined along with all the other parts in section 2.3. Any questions about that? Olay objects and other document parts. There's one more. There's the header document can also have text boxes anchored in it. So if you're really searching for all the Olay objects, you're going to want to go through the header text box document as well as the main text box document. But that's the only two that can have text boxes anchored. So those are the only two that can have floating ones. Inline ones can be in any document part that can have fields, which I think is all of them. And again, you just look through each little subdocument's field piece, and you want to find the Olay objects that are in the comment document, or the Olay objects that are in the footers or the endnotes or whatever. Same algorithm all over the place. The easiest way to find all the cases is just look for the references of police FLD, which is the field police, and you'll find all the cases in the fib that refer to all the different field pieces, and then do the same thing. Now we come to the part where we talk about modifying the file. Modifying a file in place is really, really hard. It's hard enough the Word doesn't do it itself. We keep a lock to the file, but we don't change the one you're editing. We write somewhere else and then blast over the top when we're done. Things to be careful of. If you go to update, if you add any text to the file or remove any text from the file, you've just changed CP space. And that means that every place is now wrong. You have to go fix them all to be right. If you add data into a stream anywhere, everybody who's got an offset to it is now pointing at the wrong place. You have to go fix them all. If you add properties to a ChipX FKP, all of those offsets are going to be wrong. Maybe you have to go figure that out, fix them. Your properties may not fit. The number of complexity in doing this is just huge. There is no easy way to do it. Every now and then somebody, even internally, talks about, I just want to do some light editing. There's no such thing. I was like, I just want to delete a character. Well, you've just implemented the entire thing. If you're going to delete it, once you can do that, you're there. You've done the whole thing. The other thing I wanted to stress, and I'll stress this again, is preserving stuff you don't know about is generally a recipe for corrupt files. If you really don't know what something is, and you just go writing it back in there again, you'll have offsets pointing who knows where. You'll have CPs that don't make any sense. The whole thing won't line up anymore. It's better to just throw it away. If you find the spot in the fib that talks about it, set the size of it to zero, it's gone. Word will never look at it again. Trying to keep stuff you don't know about will get you in trouble. Saving a file, on the other hand, we do this all the time. And this is actually what Word does. It loads the file up, reads it all inside, lets the user edit that whole thing. When it comes time to save, you save. In this case, the difference between this and the previous thing is that you're not trying to monkey with the thing that's already on the disk and preserve all those crazy links. You're just writing code that goes from Word stuff to your stuff, and then different code to go from your stuff back to Word stuff again. It's much easier to test those two blocks of code than it is to try and test code to manipulate the entire doc file. you won't have the problem of I saved something that I shouldn't have and it's all pointing in the wrong place, because you're saving everything you're saving. And again, this isn't just me preaching how you should do it. This is what Word actually does. We don't open the file and tweak it. We save a brand new copy right next to it, and then we do this dance where we rename the old one and put the new one on top and delete the old one. Same thing with any other format. You know, we can read WordPerfect files through an RTF-based converter from long ago. We don't crack open the WordPerfect file and party on it. We save a complete new thing through the converter and then put it on top. And again, we don't try to preserve stuff we don't know about. Odds are really good we just break WordPerfect if we did that, or whichever other format we're talking about. So yeah, that's the last thing about that is preserving unknown will just make the files corrupt. Yeah. All right, the question was, when I save a file, am I saving only the Word stuff, or am I saving all the objects as well? Well, the Ole objects is sort of a special case in that it's, in a sense, I know about Ole objects, and it's the job of the other app. If I'm able to modify the Ole object, like the Excel sheet, that means I had Excel modify it, and it saved me a copy of Excel stuff. In Word's case, what we do there is we actually let Excel edit a copy of the object instead of the one in the binary file. The reason is we want the user to be able to open the file, diddle around with it for a while, close it and say, oops, wait, I didn't want to save, and it's not saved. If I pointed Excel at the thing in the binary file that I had opened, Excel would edit that thing when it shut down sometime earlier, and then when I go to close in Word, I've now got a file that isn't what the user wanted. The user wanted his file the way it was the moment he opened it, not his file the way it was the moment he opened it, plus some random Excel modifications he made last week. So I guess the answer with Ole objects is yes, even there, we're only saving the things we know how to save. It's just that for Ole objects, that involves talking to this other app to save them. But we don't go reaching into the Excel data and fiddling around with it, if that's what you mean. That's all. Anything else? Yeah. Right, there is a book called MS-OVBA. I believe it's referenced from all of the binary books, Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. It's in its own storage. The VBA code, the macro code, and whatever else VBA keeps is in its own storage off the root. So there'll be a storage called macros. I think it's called macros. Whatever the book says it is, living off the root of the main, like it's a peer of the Word document stream will be this macro thing. And in there is all of the stuff about the names of the code and all that. Last thing that showed up a couple of times in the surveys was, what are the planned changes to this format? What changed in 2010, and what are we planning to do going forward to this format? I left the slide blank. There aren't any. There you go. Thank you. When I had to update the book when we shipped Word 2010 in order to make sure that all of the it was still accurate for the Word 2010. And all I did was go through and find all the places that said, you know, and Word 2007 does this, and then I added, and so does 2010. I think there was one case where we actually fixed a bug in 2010, so I stopped writing that we did something wrong. But other than that, it's exactly the same. And that's the plan as far as the future goes, is that this format isn't where new stuff is happening. That's what DocX is for. This format's job, as far as Word is concerned, is to let users of current versions interoperate with users who don't speak DocX. So it makes very little sense, if that's my scenario, to go stuffing things into it that other guy can't see anyway, because his version of Word doesn't do whatever it is that I'm wanting to do. Any general questions? Any more questions? Nope. Okay. Thank you.